Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Kyung-Woon Hwang, who is a professor of history at the University of Southern California. He's the author of A History of Korea, now in its second edition, and his latest book is Rationalizing Korea, The Rise of the Modern State. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kyung-Woon Hwang.
Thank you.
And obviously, the North Korean representative at the ASEAN conference in Manila, which North Korea doesn't normally get invited to, was pretty upset about these sanctions that the UN Security Council have voted on unanimously. And that in itself is pretty unusual, isn't it, for both China and Russia to weigh in. And from what I understand, the sanctions will deny, at least this is the reports we get, is it'll deny North Korea about $1 billion in revenues from exports, and that's one third of their foreign exchange. At least that's what the reports say. It's hard to believe that a country could operate only on $3 billion. But let's start with that. Are those accurate figures? And are they being punished to the tune of one third of their export income?
I don't know where those figures come from. I've read the same figures as you have just outlined. Of course, notoriously difficult to get accurate figures, whether it's economic or otherwise, from North Korea. I imagine that a lot of this comes from within Chinese sources, and that would make it fairly accurate if indeed that's the case, because the Chinese are by far the biggest trade partner with North Korea.
So cutting off exports of coal, seafood, lead, and iron, that seems to be what they're talking about. What's left? I mean, what? And also, I understand that both China and, in particular, Russia, which has been using a lot of North Korean labor in its Pacific provinces for construction work, where apparently they work really hard, long hours, and whatever pay they get goes to the North Korean government. Russia's agreed to also cut off the flow of cheap labor.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly how that's going to work. Does human labor count as an export from North Korea? Because that's what the Russians are depending on. That's what they exploit. So to what extent the Russian participation in these sanctions will have a major impact, I'm not really sure. It seems they would not be that large. Again, by far the biggest trading partner for North Korea is China. So one would think that, as you suggested, there aren't that many items currently that the North Koreans export to China. I mean, coal is lifted, but it's difficult to imagine that the North Koreans could afford to export coal. And the Chinese, of course, have a lot of coal in their own. They produce a lot of coal there. So I'm not sure how accurate that report is, but you're right. It's difficult to fathom what other things the North Koreans might be exporting that is of great value to the Chinese. I'm thinking, traditionally, people in Northern Korea cultivated ginseng and other medicinals that were highly prized in China, and to a certain extent, that's been continuing. And I'm not sure if that costs a major component of the trade right now, though.
So, obviously, though, China could do more. In other words, for example, they could cut off their exports of fuel, which North Korea is entirely dependent upon. But the Chinese don't want a collapse of that regime, do they? They don't want, I think my understanding is, one, they don't want to have a flood of refugees. And two, they've looked at the German reunification and they're kind of worried about the idea that a united Korea could be an economic juggernaut. And third, they don't want the United States military on their border.
Yeah, I think that third one is really the most important consideration from the Chinese perspective, from what they have signaled in the past. It's a security issue by far. And I think even more than having the prospect of a unified, non-Chinese-oriented Korea is the prospect of having a pro-American unified Korea on Chinese borders. So it's a typical perspective of a traditional kind of imperialist power. It's the same as Russian behavior these days. As far as the concerns over the flooding of refugees, of course, that always is a major concern. But I would think the South Koreans behind the scenes could allay those fears. And I think the South Koreans could allay some of the fears concerning the orientation of a unified Korea as well. I think that leaves us really with the prospect of an American presence right on its borders being really the most important consideration for the Chinese in not wanting to see reunification take place. But is that enough for the Chinese to continue to hold the hands of the North Korean regime that is doing things that obviously are going against the wishes of the Chinese regime itself? That's really the big question. And I think here the diplomacy that the South Koreans have been undertaking for the past, 25 years to try to overcome Chinese resistance to reunification or resistance to closer connections with South Korea have been doing. And so we'll see how far that diplomacy continues to have an effect. It's really quite striking, though, that this UN Security Council resolution did gain the consent, or at least did not get blocked by the veto of the Chinese or the Russians.
And again, I'm speaking with Kyung-moon Hwang, who is a professor of history at the University of Southern California. He's the author of A History of Korea, now in its second edition, and his latest book is Rationalizing Korea, The Rise of the Modern State. But in terms of the North Korean Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho's remarks at the ASEAN Regional Forum, it's pretty clear, and he's certainly making it clear, that under no circumstances would North Korea negotiate away its nuclear weapons. And he went on to say that since the emergence of nuclear weapons in the world, it has been proved throughout history that nukes can deter war. So is that what's going on here? That's the assumption a lot of people make, like Bruce Cummings and other analysts of North Korea, that the North Koreans learned from what happened with Saddam Hussein, where the U.S. invaded and toppled him based upon the false claim that he had nuclear weapons. And had he had them, he might have been able to deter the invasion. So is that the lesson learned?
Well, yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. The other aspect of that, though, that is just as important to keep in mind is that this regime, just like most other dictatorships, are driven first and foremost by regime preservation as the primary goal. And so this regime preservation has a military component in which your proof of having nuclear weaponry will definitely do an effective job of preventing some kind of military strike on the part of an outside force. And so that's what they're trying to do. And they make no bones about it, as you say. The other, though, aspect is that this is very important for the regime to preserve its domination within the country. And so the internal component of this propaganda is just as important. And the United States has always been, since the Korean War, a major bogeyman for the northern regime to prop itself up, to strengthen its legitimacy and to sustain its legitimacy after the death of the founder himself. And the founder himself was, of course, very eager to fabricate his own history in relation to the United States, saying that the North Koreans not only beat back an American invasion in the Korean War, but that Kim Il-sung himself, the founder, was the one who made that possible. And so the regime's legitimacy has been based on these extraordinarily bitter and horrific memories of American bombing in the Korean War. And so the Americans will continue to have this very important utilitarian value for internal propaganda in order to sustain the regime. And I think that's really important to keep in mind.
Well, I've asked a number of experts on Korea the question of whether, as you recall, Gorbachev, before the end of the Cold War, made the announcement that we will no longer be the USA's enemy. In other words, you're not going to have a Cold War enemy anymore. And he did that with some sort of irony. So I've suggested that what would happen if the US suddenly plonked a peace treaty on the table at Panmunjom and said, let's end the Korean War. It's an armistice, it's not a treaty. And we don't want to be your enemy anymore. Now, I know it's incredibly naive, but that would take away the glue that holds that regime together. So I suppose to that extent, it's never going to happen. But what's your thoughts on that matter?
Well, I think it It will happen. It would happen if indeed that was done. I think putting forth a peace treaty on the table with North Korea would go a long way toward not only solving the immediate problem, or at least helping to solve the immediate problem of nuclear proliferation on the part of North Korea. And the North Koreans, I think, will never really give up their nuclear weapons, but they can be coaxed, perhaps, into stopping the growth or stopping further development. But in the long run, I think that's exactly what can be done with such a stand down from the hostility, and that is to, hopefully anyway, make gains toward conducing an opening up of the country. And that has been proven throughout history over the past, half a century, or at least past 30 or so years. That is going to be the most important effective way of changing North Korea. I think that would really is ultimately the only way to bring about some kind of resolution to this continuing crisis that we seem to have with North Korea. You know, it is a terrible regime, but you do have to, I think, find some kind of longer-term strategy to make things better for the regional and national community in the security sense, but also to make things better for the suffering North Korean population. And I think, given that, it might not be a bad idea to do something striking like that, and that is to say, hey, you know, we Americans do not want to be your enemy. We want to pursue some kind of formal peace treaty. As long as the South Koreans are involved in this, I think it can work and it can be effective.
Well, Secretary of State Tillerson didn't go that far, of course, but he did say that the U.S. is not interested in regime change, which was a clear, you know, olive branch, because most of the rhetoric, and he, I don't think he got the entire support of the Trump administration behind him, by the way. We don't exactly know. It's hard to know what's going on with that crowd. You know, one day it's tweeting one thing and the next another. So it's almost impossible to follow foreign policy in the Trump administration. But what would prevent the U.S. or and or the South Koreans from taking an imaginative step like that to plonk a peace treaty on the table and say, okay, we don't want to be your enemy anymore?
That's a good question. The thing that comes to mind immediately to me is Donald Trump. You know, it's tough. It's difficult to get him to think about anything in depth and to, you know, numb his itchy fingers, whether it's for tweeting or for anything else more dangerous. And I should say here that from my perspective as a longtime Korea watcher, the most disruptive thing that has happened over the past half a year concerning North Korea has been Donald Trump. Nothing really has changed that much. Even with the constant missile tests and all that, we knew that the nuclear program has been developing for 20 years. Nothing really has changed that fundamentally except for the insertion of this wild card, and that was the Trump administration. So I'm not really sure whether something sensible can result from the current American government. But you never know. So, I mean, I'm glad I'm not in the prediction game, because it would be difficult to do so with the administration.
Well, it's pretty clear, though, from North Korea's response to the sort of chance meeting at this dinner at the ASEAN conference on Sunday night, where the North Korean foreign minister, Ri, sort of ran into his South Korean counterpart, and they had a brief chat. But then Ri then quickly rebuffed any idea of negotiations, saying that the offer that was made was insincere. That tells me that, isn't that a part of the game? The North Koreans don't want to talk to the South because they figure you're a puppet state. We have to talk to the puppet master, the Americans.
Yeah, that's at least the formal stance anyway. It's always been the formal stance. Although, of course, the North Koreans have talked directly with the South Koreans frequently over the past few decades. And so I think there's some kind of instability, if you want to call it that, or discombobulation taking place in the northern regime in response to this UN Security Council resolution. And so it's difficult to fathom any kind of large consistency aside from the typical bombast, as we have seen. Although they did have a formal state or government declaration in response to that resolution. That's not that usual. So that was interesting. I think that's really more of a sign as to how the North Koreans are trying to figure out what exactly to do in response to this, with Russia and China now on board in the sanctions.
Well, are the North Koreans lucky to get aboard the Moscow and Beijing, the Chinese and the Russian plan for a what they call a freeze for a freeze, where North Korea freezes its missile and nuclear testing while the U.S. and its allies stop conducting joint military exercises?
Yeah, I think it's difficult for me to be sure about this kind of thing, of course, but I would gather that the northern regime would be open to that kind of negotiation. And you have to understand that there's a lot of historical support for the North spheres of the United States based on the Korean War and based on what happened thereafter as well, but especially based on the Korean War. And you would think that if the northern regime can be assured of keeping its current stockpile, even if they can't develop it any further, and bring about what they have always seen as the worst and most provocative event, and that is the annual military exercises with South Korea and the United States, which, again, they have a legitimate gripe about, which they have a legitimate fear of. And I think that that retains a strong possibility of gaining acceptance by the northern regime.
Well, Kyung Moon Hwang, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Kyung Moon Hwang, who is a professor of history at the University of Southern California. He's the author of A History of Korea Now in its second edition, and his latest book is Rationalizing Korea, The Rise of the Modern State. We're going to take a brief station break and be back investigating the real reasons behind the opioid crisis in America and why the epidemic is not being dealt with effectively.